and it still makes sense as, please give the documents to me. You'll often hear smart people get this rule wrong, so don't be fooled by how many times you hear it incorrectly. Less or fewer. People often say less when they should say fewer. For example, it's bad grammar to say, I have less friends than before. When the subject is plural, as in friends, you use fewer. I have fewer friends than before. It's okay to say you have less hair than before, but if you were talking about your individual strands of hair, you would say, I have fewer strands of hair. Theory versus hypothesis. Non-scientists often use the word theory when they should say hypothesis. Without getting too technical, a theory is a scientific explanation of reality that is so well tested that it is as good as a fact. The correct term for an unproven and untested explanation is hypothesis. For example, I think it is possible that humans are the result of aliens seeding Earth with life that evolved over millions of years. I have no evidence for that idea, so it's merely a hypothesis. In conversations with friends, I might call it a theory. If I blog about it, I'll play it safe and try to remember to call it a hypothesis. I've probably had more complaints about my inappropriate use of the word theory than any other thing I've done to anger the public. And that's a long list. I've made most of the grammar mistakes I mentioned, and I often hear them from others. Bad grammar isn't the worst flaw you could have, but when you consider how easily you can fix it, the effort-to-reward ratio is excellent. It's well worth your effort to learn how to avoid the most common grammatical errors. Persuasion. No matter your calling in life, you'll spend a great deal of time trying to persuade people to do one thing or another. You might be a salesperson trying to close deals, a minister trying to save souls, or anyone with a boss, a family, or friends. Nearly every interaction with others involves some form of persuasion, even if it's subtle. Wouldn't it make sense to learn how to persuade more effectively? A good starting point in learning the art of persuasion is to go to your preferred online bookstore and search for Persuasion. You'll see a number of books on the topic. Keep reading those books until they seem to be repeating the same tricks. You'll be amazed how deep the topic of persuasion is. And you'll use what you've learned in just about every business or personal interaction you have for the rest of your life. Being a good persuader is like having a magic power. There is an ethical consideration, of course. You don't want to persuade people to do things that are not in their best interest. And it might feel creepy and manipulative if you find yourself too skilled at persuasion. I've learned so much on the topic of persuasion that I intentionally dial it back when I feel like I'm in a stick fight with someone who has no stick. I'm sometimes happier not getting my way than I would be if I felt manipulative. It's a powerful skill that should be used judiciously. I'll give you a taste of the topic just so you know what I'm talking about. For starters, some words and phrases are simply more persuasive than others, and that has been demonstrated in controlled studies. I've included a few of my own favorite persuasion words based on my own experiences. Persuasive words and phrases. Because. Would you mind? I'm not interested. I don't do that. I have a rule. I just wanted to clarify. Is there anything you can do for me? Thank you. This is just between you and me. Allow me to elaborate. Because. Studies by psychologist Robert Cialdini show that people are more cooperative when you ask for a favor using a sentence that includes the word because, even if the reason you offer makes little or no sense. Apparently, the word because signals reasonableness, and reasonableness allows people to let down their defenses and drop their objections. If the science is accurate, an effective way to ask for money might look something like this. May I borrow $100 because I don't get paid until next week? That's not much of a justification for borrowing money. No real reason is given. The person asking for money hasn't even said why he needs it. It just feels as if a reason had been offered because of because. I've tested this technique and it works surprisingly well. Would you mind? I found that any question beginning with, "Would you mind?" tends to be well received. My best guess is that asking a person if he minds is signaling that you have a reasonable request that might be inconvenient. It's hard to be a jerk and say no to any request that starts with, "Would you mind?" The question comes across as honest, while also showing concern for the other person. It's a powerful combination. "I'm not interested." Sometimes you need to persuade someone to stop trying to persuade you. You are in that situation every time a telemarketer calls or someone tries to sell you something you don't want. The worst thing you can do in that sort of situation is give some logical-sounding reason why you don't want whatever is being sold. People who sell for a living will try to talk you out of your reason with reasons of their own. In fact, they are usually equipped with arguments against every common objection. Likewise, your friends will badger you forever if you offer nothing but good reasons for rejecting their ideas. I've found that the most effective way to stop people from trying to persuade me is to say, "I'm not interested." You should try it. Don't offer a reason why you aren't interested. No one can say why a thing holds interest for some and not for others. There's no argument against a lack of interest. Repeat your claim of disinterest as often as it takes to end the conversation. You might be surprised how effective this method is. I've been using it for years. It's a total conversation killer. "I don't do that." Another good persuasion sentence is, "I don't do that." It's not a reason and barely tries to be, but it sounds like a hard and fast rule. If someone asks you to attend the annual asparagus festival, don't say it doesn't sound like fun. That's just begging the asparagus lovers in your group to endlessly describe just how joyous it could be if only you would try it. Instead, say something like, "I don't do food festivals." And if anyone asks why, say, "I'm just not interested." Some of these persuasive sentences work well in tandem. "I have a rule." In a similar vein, another good anti-persuasion technique is to say you have a rule. For example, let's say you have a lunch scheduled with a potential client and your obnoxious coworker asks if he can join you. Honesty won't work because you have to coexist with your coworker. Instead, say something along the lines of, "I have a rule of only doing one-on-one lunches with clients." It will sound convincing and somewhat polite, while offering no reason whatsoever. "I just wanted to clarify." Sometimes you hear statements that are so mind-numbingly stupid, evil, or mean that you know a direct frontal assault would only start a fight. People tend to double down when challenged, no matter how wrong they are. A more effective way to approach a dangerous social or business situation is sideways, by asking a question that starts with, "I just wanted to clarify." That approach might look like this. "I just wanted to clarify. Are you saying you're okay with an 80% chance of going to jail? Or did I hear your plan wrong?" If you phrase your clarification question correctly, it will shine an indirect light on the problem and provide a face-saving escape path. In many cases, the clarification you receive will actually be an entirely new and more rational plan. No one likes to be proven wrong, but most people will be happy to clarify, even if the clarification is a complete reversal of an earlier position. It just feels different when you call something a clarification. "Is there anything you can do for me?" We all find ourselves in situations where an organization or person is preventing us from achieving whatever it is that we perceive as just and fair. Perhaps a retail store is refusing to take a return item, or you purchased the wrong model and the one you want is out of stock. You need to persuade someone to go above and beyond the rules to make you happy. You know that if you get angry and demanding, the person you're dealing with might stick to the rules and try to brush you off. The most powerful way to approach a situation like this is to ask, "Is there anything you can do for me?" You will discover it to be an extraordinarily persuasive question. The question frames you as the helpless victim and the person you are trying to persuade as the hero and problem solver. That's a self-image that people like to reinforce when they have the chance. All you're doing is creating that opportunity. When you deputize someone to be your problem solver, you create a situation in which he or she has a clear payoff. Helping nice people always feels good. All you need to do is be polite and ask a direct question. "Is there anything you can do for me?" You'll be amazed how well it works. Thank you. Thank you can range from a casual thanks to an over-the-top expression of appreciation complete with details. There's a big difference in how effective each approach is likely to be. When I took a class on how to train our dog, one of the first things we learned is that the quality of the dog treats made a big difference in how cooperative the dog would be. The trainer had the good stuff, and I believe she could make those dogs play the piano if she wanted. Our medium-quality treats were just barely good enough to keep the dog from turning on us. The trainer admitted that the key to her superior results with dogs was partly snack quality. A thank you is like a treat for a human. When you do something generous or nice, you like to know it's appreciated. The quality of the thank you matters as much with humans as the quality of the treats matters to dogs. If you want people to like you, for business or for your personal life, pay special attention to the quality of your thanks. Thank you notes sent by snail mail are always appreciated, and still a must for the bigger occasions. But a well-written email is now socially acceptable for most common situations. No matter how you deliver a thank you, make sure it includes a little detail of what makes you thankful. Was it the surprise, the thoughtfulness, or how helpful the favor or gift was? Be specific. For example, "Thank you so much for the ride. I was worried all day about how I would get everything done while my car is in the shop. You really saved me." Compare that with a simple "thank you for the ride." Any thank you is better than none, but you're missing an opportunity if you do a poor job of it. It's the sort of thing people remember when they decide whom they want to work with, pick for a team, or invite to a party. It seems like a small thing, but it isn't. This is just between you and me. Research shows that people will automatically label you a friend if you share a secret. Sharing a confidence is a fast-track way to cause people to like and trust you. The trick is to reveal a secret that isn't a dangerous one. Wrong. "I buried my boss in the backyard." Right. "I probably shouldn't admit this, but every time Jane serves her dip, I only pretend to like it because everyone else says it's to die for." The right approach to sharing a secret is to start small. Make sure the small secrets stay secret before you try anything riskier. One way to judge your risk is to be alert for other people's secrets that are being relayed to you. Someone who is bad at keeping one kind of secret is probably bad at keeping all secrets. You won't be exempt. Decisiveness. No one is decisive all the time. The world is a complicated place, and often we're only guessing which path will be best. Anyone who is confident in the face of great complexity is insane. However, some people act much more decisively than others, and that can be both persuasive and useful. Decisiveness looks like leadership. Keep in mind that most normal people are at least a little bit uncertain when facing unfamiliar and complicated situations. What people crave in that sort of environment is anything that looks like certainty. If you can deliver an image of decisiveness, no matter how disingenuous, others will see it as leadership. Don't confuse your artificial sense of decisiveness with a need to be right all of the time. Life is messy, and you're going to be right only sometimes. You'll do everyone in your life a favor by acting decisively, though, even if you have doubts on the inside. Energy. People respond to energy in others. If you show how much you love a particular form of entertainment, it will be easier to persuade others to try it. Energy is contagious. People like how it feels. If you show enthusiasm, others will want to experience the same rush. Insanity. In most groups, the craziest person is in control. It starts because no one wants the problems that come from pissing off a crazy person. It's just smarter and easier sometimes to let the crazy person have his or her way. Crazy people also take more risks and act more confidently than the facts would warrant. That's a potent combination. Crazy plus confident probably kills more people than any other combination of personality traits, but when it works just right, it's a recipe for extraordinary persuasion. Cults are a good example of insanity being viewed as leadership. Suppose you're not insane. Can insanity help you? The answer is yes, but you want to use a calculated, emotional type of insanity. In any kind of negotiation, the worst thing you can do is act reasonable. Reasonable people generally cave in to irrational people because it seems like the path of least resistance. The way fake insanity works in a negotiation is that you assign a greater value to some element of a deal than an objective observer would consider reasonable. For example, you might demand that a deal be closed before the holidays so you can announce it to your family as a holiday present. When you bring in an emotional dimension, people know they can't talk you out of it. Emotions don't bend to reason. So wrap your arguments in whatever emotional blankets you can think of to influence others. A little bit of irrationality is a powerful thing. Is persuasion the same as manipulation? If you see persuasion as a form of manipulation, and you see manipulation as a form of evil, that worldview will keep you from being as persuasive as you might be. I think most people hold back their full powers of persuasion because it doesn't feel good to be manipulative. It's one thing to speak your mind and voice your preferences, but you hope that other people agree with you because of the thundering rightness of your arguments. Sadly, we do not live in a world where good arguments always win. Sometimes you need to nudge people onto the right path, even if they firmly believe it to be wrong. In some cases, you have a moral obligation to be manipulative if you know it will create a good result for all involved. For example, manipulating coworkers to do better work is usually good for everyone. Technology, hobby level. Technology once was the exclusive domain of lonely geeks. Those days are over. Every adult should have a basic understanding of how the internet works, the steps involved in building a website, what the cloud is, and of course how to use personal computers, smartphones, tablets, etc. It's hard to imagine any profession or startup that wouldn't require those skills at some level, even if you're doing nothing more than supervising vendors, outsourcing, and managing others. It's a good idea to master technology at what I would call a hobby level. You don't need to be your own tech support for the hard stuff, but you also don't want to be the only person in the room who doesn't understand the topic. This is another case in which your personal energy can be your guide. Imagine how you feel when you find yourself in a technology discussion that you don't understand. It's not fun, and it's not energizing. You can feel your soul draining out through your socks. On the other hand, being part of the conversation is always energizing if you feel you have something to add. Technology is part of the fabric of civilization, and you need to jack into it if you haven't already. Learn the basics, and you'll be a lot happier. Proper voice technique. It's helpful to have different vocal strategies for different situations. Your fun voice might be higher pitched and more rapid paced, whereas your serious voice might be deeper and more measured. It's important to keep a lot of distance between your fun voice and your persuasive voice. For people who know you, the serious voice will send an unambiguous signal that the topic is important and you might not be open to negotiating. My guess is that only 20% or less of the general public speaks with proper voice mechanics. And by that I mean proper breath control, tone, and mouth strategies. You probably think any improvement to your voice quality would be wasted. After all, the people you speak with understand you perfectly. But research shows that voice quality is far more important to your overall health and happiness than you might imagine. Studies show a commanding voice is highly correlated with success. Other studies suggest that both men and women with attractive voices find partners more quickly than those with less attractive voices. While most of us will never be able to speak like Morgan Freeman, no matter how diligently we train our voices, we're all capable of improving how we speak. And that's probably worth the effort. One of the strangest patterns I noticed during my corporate career was that many of the higher-level managers seemed to have distinctive, interesting voices that commanded attention and gave an inexplicable weight to everything they said. I'm willing to bet that you could play voice recordings of employees to a group of volunteers, and the subjects could accurately predict, at least better than chance, who will ascend to power and who will remain a worker bee. One study showed that nurse managers tended to have stronger voices, and this was correlated with the perceived higher quality of care and greater management abilities. Throughout my corporate years, I used a serious-sounding tone of voice whenever I was in professional mode. I was literally acting, but it didn't feel disingenuous because the business world is a lot like theater. Everyone tries to get into character for the job they have. When I was a bank teller, I was obsequious to customers. When I managed people, I spoke in a way that I thought sounded authoritarian and reasonable. In meetings with higher-ups, I lowered my tone and spoke with the sort of self-assurance that only the insane come by honestly. I'm reasonably sure that my fake voice, with its low notes and artificial confidence, made me appear more capable than I was. And that wasn't difficult, because I was largely incompetent at every corporate job I held. Despite my obvious lack of ability, nearly every boss I had, and there were many, identified me as a future corporate executive. Keep in mind that I was poorly dressed, 5 feet 8 inches tall, and prematurely balding in my 20s. I certainly didn't look like CEO material, and while I'd like to think my interior brilliance sometimes shined through, I doubt that was the case. I think my fake professional voice and body language were at least half of the reason I was seen as having management potential. I also noticed during my corporate years that women who had never met me in person flirted like crazy on the phone whenever I used my fake professional voice. I assume the same voice qualities that indicate potential for leadership also influence potential mates. My fake confidence, along with my fake low voice that screamed testosterone, worked like catnip on the ladies. Unfortunately, the flirting stopped as soon as anyone saw me in person. That's why I assume my fake voice was the secret sauce. At least one voice expert believes that my fake voice, with its artificially low tone, was a cause of my later voice problems with spasmodic dysphonia. I don't know that to be true, but it's worth mentioning. This book isn't designed to give you voice lessons, but I'll include a few common methods for developing your best success voice. For starters, it helps to learn to breathe from the bottom of your lungs, not in the upper chest area. Proper breathing has lots of other benefits, including stress reduction, increased and more efficient metabolism, and better physical stamina. So it's worth learning. If you put your hand on your belly button and breathe correctly, that's the only part of your torso that should be rising and falling. If your upper chest is expanding when you breathe normally, you're doing it wrong. When you get your breathing right, your words will come out sounding more confident. Next, you need to pick a tone. Some voice experts will tell you that your best and most natural tone is probably higher than the way you normally speak. Many people have a natural tendency to speak lower to other humans than they might to a pet, for example. On some level, we all understand that lower voices confer some weight to what we say. The downside of a lower voice is that it's difficult to hear words that match background noise. In my fake voice era, no one could hear me above crowd noises. It was hard to order a drink or make conversation in any noisy situation. I've since learned to penetrate background noise by using a higher-pitched voice. It's great for communicating, but I don't expect to get any CEO offers. It's a real trade-off. Another common speaking trick is to hum the first part of the Happy Birthday song and then speak in your normal voice right after. You'll notice your post-humming voice is strangely smooth and perfect. The effect won't last long, but it gives you a target voice that you know you can get to with practice. Posture is also important for good speech. If you don't sit up straight or stand straight, your vocal equipment will be pinched, and it will sound that way even if you don't notice it yourself. When you're trying to convey a fake sense of confidence, which is often handy, you need to tell yourself you're acting. Simply speak the way you imagine a confident person would speak, and you'll nail it on the first try. You want to get rid of the hemming and hawing, the ums and ahs, and anything that disrupts your flow. That takes practice. The quickest fix is simply to substitute silence where you once had ums and ahs. It will feel uncomfortable at first, but you'll get used to it. I also like to form full sentences in my head before I start them, at least whenever that's an option. And when I know a topic is likely to come up in the near future, I practice entire conversations in my head until I can speak my thoughts fluently. My list of combinable skills isn't meant to be comprehensive, and every person is in a unique situation. For you, maybe the right skills are photography and botany. You'll recognize them when you see them now that your mind is tuned to think in that way. Chapter 22. Pattern Recognition. One of my systems involves continually looking for patterns in life. Recently, I noticed that the high school volleyball games I attended in my role as stepdad were almost always won by the team that reached 17 first, even though the winning score is 25 and you have to win by 2. It's common for the lead to change often during a volleyball match, and the team that first reaches 17 might fall behind a few more times before winning, which makes the pattern extra strange. If the volleyball pattern is real, and that is far from settled, I would assume there is a normal explanation for it. Perhaps 17 just feels so close to 25 that the team that is behind feels deflated and the team that is ahead feels extra confident. Perhaps at the high school level, the coach who is behind feels the need to give the bench players some time before the end of the game. Whatever the reason, the pattern seems to hold. Perhaps it will change before this book goes to print. I'll keep tracking it. In amateur tennis, one of the oddest patterns is called the 5-2 curse. In tennis, the first player to win 6 games by at least 2 wins the set. So you would expect the player who first reaches 5 to win most of the time. What happens instead, far more often than common sense would predict, is that the weekend player who is ahead feels he can coast, while the player who is behind feels he can play relaxed because the outcome seems predictable. That sort of thinking leads to a psychological advantage for the player who is behind, who often closes the gap to 5-3 without much effort. Now the player who is ahead starts to think the lead isn't so secure. Perhaps he feels that the momentum has shifted. It only takes a few good shots from the opponent in the next game to reinforce that impression. The player who first gets to 5 games against a similarly skilled amateur will still win most of the time, but not nearly as often as you would predict. If you are an amateur player with only 2 games compared with your opponent's 5, it helps a great deal to know you have something like a 40% chance of prevailing. Knowing the pattern changes how you think about your chances, and that change in thinking can then improve your performance. Successful people. Countless self-help and business books have tried to find the patterns of behavior that make people successful. If we can find out what successful people do, so the thinking goes, we can imitate them and become successful ourselves. Stephen Covey was probably the most famous of the success by pattern gurus. His book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, sold more than 25 million copies. I think Covey described a good set of patterns for people to follow, but they are only a start. I'll summarize his 7 habits and suggest you read his books if you want more. 1. Be proactive. 2. Begin with the end in mind. Imagine a good outcome. 3. Put first things first. Set priorities. 4. Think win-win. Don't be greedy. 5. Seek first to understand, then be understood. 6. Synergize. Use teamwork. 7. Sharpen the saw. Keep learning. The holy grail of civilization is to someday make all people successful by discovering the formula used by successful people and making it available to all. As far as I know, Stephen Covey's 7 habits didn't budge the poverty rate, so there are probably deeper patterns at play. Here's my own list of the important patterns for success that I've noticed over the years. This is purely anecdotal. I exclude the ones that are 100% genetic. 1. Lack of fear of embarrassment. 2. Education, the right kind. 3. Exercise. A lack of fear of embarrassment is what allows one to be proactive. It's what makes a person take on challenges that others write off as too risky. It's what makes you take the first step before you know what the second step is. I'm not a fan of physical risks, but if you can't handle the risk of embarrassment, rejection, and failure, you need to learn how, and studies suggest that it is indeed a learnable skill. As far as physical bravery goes, I don't know anything about it. But I'm glad some people have it so they can shoot the other people who have it before those people shoot me. I recommend that you improve your psychological bravery, but say no to anything that has a strong chance of killing you. Then there's education. Do you know what the unemployment rate is for engineers? It is nearly zero. Do you know how many engineers like their jobs? Most of them do, despite what you read in Dilbert comics. And the ones who are unhappy with work can change jobs fairly easily. Generally speaking, the people who have the right kind of education have almost no risk of unemployment. Education and psychological bravery are somewhat interchangeable. If you don't have much of one, you can compensate with a lot of the other. When you see a successful person who lacks a college education, you're usually looking at someone with an unusual lack of fear. The next pattern I've noticed is exercise. Good health is a baseline requirement for success. But I'm not talking about the obvious fact that sick people can't get much done. I'm talking about the extra energy and vitality that good health brings. I might be getting the correlation wrong, and perhaps whatever motivates a person to succeed also motivates that person to maintain an exercise schedule. But I think it works both ways. I believe exercise makes people smarter, psychologically braver, more creative, more energetic, and more influential. In an online article about 20 habits of successful people, the second item on the list is exercise 5 to 7 days a week. Other studies back this notion. Physical fitness and daily exercise are correlated with success in business and in life. There's one more pattern I see in successful people. They treat success as a learnable skill. That means they figure out what they need and they go and get it. If you've listened this far, you're one of those people. You're listening to this book because it offers a non-zero chance of telling you something that might be helpful. Chapter 23. Humor. If you see humor as an optional form of entertainment, you're missing some of its biggest benefits. People who enjoy humor are simply more attractive than people who don't. It's human nature to want to spend time with people who can appreciate a good laugh, or, better yet, cause one. Take it from me when I say a good sense of humor can compensate for a lot of other shortcomings in one's looks and personality. Humor makes average-looking people look cute, and uninteresting people seem entertaining. Studies show that a good sense of humor even makes you seem smarter. One study showed that women seek out men with a better sense of humor because it can signal that they may be amusing, kind, understanding, dependable. Best of all, and central to the theme of this book, humor raises your energy, and that can reverberate into everything you do at school, at work, or in your personal life. The boost of energy will even make you more willing to exercise, and that will raise your overall energy even more. Humor also transports your mind away from your daily troubles. Humor puts life in perspective, and sometimes helps you laugh at even the worst of your problems. Because humor directly influences your energy levels, it touches every part of your life that requires concentration and willpower. And for the most part, humor is free and easily accessible. The internet is full of humor. If you don't have funny friends, find some. If you're a reader, choose funny books. If you go to movies, choose the funny ones first and avoid anything you know will end on a sad note. Sometimes you want to dispense a bit of your own humor. That comes naturally to some people, but not most. In my experience, most people think they have a sense of humor, and to some extent that's true. But not all senses of humor are created equal. So I thought it would be useful to include some humor tips for everyday life. In two of my other books, I talk a bit about my formula for writing humor, so I won't repeat that here. If you're interested in creating written humor, check out The Joy of Work, Dilbert 2.0, and Stick to Drawing Comics, Monkey Brain. In those books, I talk about the tricks and mechanics of writing humor. You don't have to be the joke teller in the group in order to demonstrate your sense of humor. You can be the one who steers the conversation to fun topics that are ripe for others to add humor. Every party needs a straight person. You'll appear fun and funny by association. When it comes to in-person humor, effort counts a lot. When people see you trying to be funny, it frees them to try it themselves. So even if your own efforts at humor fall short, you might be freeing the pent-up humor in others. People need permission to be funny in social or business settings because there's always a risk that comes with humor. You will do people a big favor when you remove some of that risk by going first. For in-person humor, quality isn't as important as you might think. Your attitude and effort count for a lot. Obviously, you want to avoid the label of tries too hard when it comes to humor. That's generally a problem only if you laugh too vigorously at your own jokes or other people's jokes. So-called dry humor is the best strategy if you plan to go for quantity. I say quality is overrated when it comes to humor, but you do need to achieve a minimum threshold. And that usually means avoiding a handful of traps. If you avoid the traps, you're golden. Allow me to map the traps for you. I'll start with a summary, then explain. Over-complaining is never funny. Don't overdo the self-deprecation. Don't mock people. Avoid puns and wordplay. Some people, and I was one of them, believe that humorous complaints about the little aggravations of life constitute humor. And sometimes that is the case. The problem comes when you start doing too much gripe-based humor. One funny observation about a problem in your life can be funny, but five is just complaining, no matter how witty you think you are. Funny complaints can wear people out. Self-deprecating humor is usually the safest type, but here again, you don't want to overshoot the target. One self-deprecating comment is a generous and even confident form of humor. You have to be at least a bit self-assured to mock yourself in front of others. But if you do it too often, you can transform in the eyes of others from a confident jokester to a chihuahua. Don't make fun of people too often. If that starts to look like a pattern, people will assume you're talking behind their backs as well. Beware of puns and other clever wordplay. The only people who appreciate puns are the people who can do them. It's like water polo. It's hard to appreciate the sport unless you've played it. If you don't know for sure that you're dealing with hardcore pun lovers, avoid puns completely. Otherwise, you're just begging for a courtesy snort or an eye roll. Humor also makes you more creative, at least in the short run. I think it has something to do with the fact that humor is a violation of straight-line thinking. Humor temporarily shuts down the common-sense program in your moist robot brain and boots the random idea generator. At least it feels that way to me, figuratively speaking. Perhaps all that is happening is that humor makes one feel energized and relaxed at the same time, and that is bound to help creativity. Tailor your humor. One of the most reliable, albeit sexist, generalizations I've noticed over the years is that women tend to laugh at stories involving bad things happening to people, such as an attractive girl taking a faceplant into a mud puddle on the way to the prom. Guys like that sort of humor too, but my observation is that men are far more likely to enjoy traditional joke-like stories that are more engineered than organic. Know your audience. Some people believe that bathroom humor and references to genitalia are the only valid forms of humor. Others look for cleverness. You won't win anyone over to your preferred brand of humor. It's better to adapt to what others want to hear, assuming your goal is to be liked. People generally broadcast their sense of humor from the moment you meet. You can observe what people laugh at, what sort of stories they tell, and whether they have an edgy personality. If I hear someone say, "Gosh," or "Holy mackerel," I leave out the profanity from my stories. If I say something mildly clever and get a reaction, I know I can turn the cleverness spigot on full. It's a good idea to test an approach before committing. Jim's colonoscopy story. My friend Jim tells a funny story about his colonoscopy appointment. Per his doctor's instructions, he purged himself the day before the appointment by drinking a powerful laxative and spending the better part of the day in the bathroom. As Jim tells it, he was squeaky clean in his backdoor region by the time he visited the doctor. At this point in the story, you can see the structure developing. As the listener, you already know something bad is going to happen to Jim, and it will somehow involve his anal area. That's the sign of a good story. Now, back to it. As Jim tells the story, the cleansing process was a long and unpleasant one. But since he only needs to do it once every year or so, it's worth the unpleasantness. Jim walked into the doctor's office and proudly announced his readiness for the colonoscopy. The receptionist checked her calendar and said, "Your appointment is tomorrow." That's the punchline, and it illustrates two interesting points about storytelling. First, you can probably sense that the story would be far funnier in person. You will discover that some types of humor work best in person. Jim's story is an in-person type. As you listened to it here, you probably managed little more than a smile, if that. Told in person, it gets a huge laugh every time. The second interesting point is that Jim's story saves the bad part for your imagination. His second day of cleansing will obviously be unpleasant. But the joke ends with the simple knowledge that unpleasant times are ahead. In general, you want your punchline to inspire listeners to complete the story, including the bad part, in their own minds. That allows every person to imagine the ending in the way that is most amusing. Engineered humor. An engineered joke is one that includes an unlikely or surprising solution to a problem, much the way an engineer discovers a novel way to fix something that is broken. For example, in 2010, the world watched the drama of the Chilean coal miners who were trapped underground for days. A small hole from the surface to their tiny underground space was their only source of oxygen, food, and water. The world was emotionally connected to these miners, praying for their rescue. Meanwhile, stories started emerging that some of the miners had both wives and mistresses. My friend Laura heard the stories of the mistresses and quipped, "If I were one of those wives, I'd be shoveling dirt down that air hole." That's an engineering solution to a problem not normally solved by engineering. You can visualize the angry wife hearing the news of her husband's mistress and shoveling dirt down the hole while cursing. It's a funny image, at least for people who have a warped sense of humor. I laughed for about a week. I realize that my stereotypes about the type of humor that women enjoy versus men won't hold for all people. For example, Laura created one of the best engineered jokes I've heard. But I think you'll find the gender generalization about humor to be about 80% true. Chapter 24. Affirmations. In my book, The Dilbert Future, I describe my odd experience with something called affirmations. You'll need to know the backstory about my experience with affirmations to have a context for understanding my unwavering optimism against long odds, including my voice problem. Affirmations are simply the practice of repeating to yourself what you want to achieve while imagining the outcome you want. You can write it, speak it, or just think it in sentence form. The typical form of an affirmation would be, "I, Scott Adams, will become an astronaut." The details of affirmations probably don't matter much because the process is about improving your focus, not summoning magic. Apparently, I failed badly at my first attempt to write about affirmations in The Dilbert Future. I had intended to make a point about the limits of human perception and how they might be holding us back. Based on the angry email I got and the buzz on the internet, apparently most people interpreted my point to mean I believe in magic. The skeptics of the world were apoplectic about what they perceived as my promotion of magical thinking to an irrational and gullible public. So let me start by clearly stating that I don't believe in magic. But like most of you, I have experienced several events in my life that are indistinguishable from magic, in the same way a caveman might perceive your phone as magic. My point then and now is that you don't need to know why something works to take advantage of it. A caveman could successfully use a phone, assuming someone taught him how, while continuing to believe its inner workings were based on magic. His faulty perceptions would have no impact on the usefulness of the phone, at least until it broke and he started praying to it. Affirmations might be a bit like the caveman and the phone. You can make your own judgment about whether my story that follows is a case of coincidence, selective memory, simple luck, hard work, greater focus, tuning my mind, hidden talent, or whatever you like. My perception, which I assume for the sake of consistency is flawed, is that affirmations are useful, and I have no idea why. Let me simply tell you what happened when I tried affirmations, and you can judge for yourself. But let's agree to rule out magic as one of the options. How it started. As I mentioned earlier, in my mid-20s, I took a class to learn hypnosis, and I got to know some of the students outside of class. One of my classmates called me at home to say she had read a book about affirmations, tried it, and experienced some hugely unlikely results, at least according to her own estimate of the odds. She strongly recommended I try it. It would cost me nothing but time, which I had in abundance during those years, so I said I'd give it a try. My real agenda was to debunk it. I assumed it was complete bullshit. But it is my preference to be open-minded when I can manage it, so I went into it with the intention of giving it a fair try. My first affirmation was, "I, Scott, will become rich." The long version of the story involves two ridiculously lucky stock picks that came to me out of nowhere in separate flashes of something that felt like intuition. But I didn't trust affirmations enough to invest heavily in stocks that came to my attention through some sort of irrational process. I invested nothing in the first stock because of a paperwork snafu, and it subsequently went to the moon. I bought and quickly sold the second stock for a respectable gain, and then watched from the sidelines as it, too, zoomed up. Both stocks were big stories that year, and among the top gainers out of a field of perhaps 10,000 possible stocks. I didn't pick any other stocks during that time. My affirmation failed to make me rich, at least right away. But I wondered, what were the odds that I could pick two of the best stocks of the year back-to-back with zero research? Obviously, it could be pure luck. A monkey could pick two winning stocks in a row, at least some of the time. But it was enough of a tease to encourage me to try again with another affirmation. My second attempt involved a girl I perceived to be far out of my league. I'll shortcut that story by saying a series of coincidences lined up to make the unlikely happen, albeit briefly. But again, this wasn't proof that affirmations worked. Maybe I'm just a good stock picker and far more handsome than my lying mirror is willing to admit. Whatever the real reason for my success, I got enough of a payoff to encourage me to keep trying affirmations just in case there was something to them. My next affirmation was more personal than I can describe here, but it happened to be the type of thing for which I could calculate the odds with some degree of certainty, similar to how you might know a lottery winner beat odds of 10 million to 1. In my case, I beat odds that I calculated to be somewhere in the 10,000 to 1 range, and none of it required hard work, skill, or connections. I pause here to acknowledge the possibility that selective memory is behind my perceptions. Perhaps I tried lots of affirmations and only remember the ones that seemed to work. I can't rule that out. Maybe I was a good stock picker, a total stud who didn't realize it, and lucky like a lottery winner. Or perhaps I am terrible at estimating the odds of particular events happening. Any one of those explanations is possible. I tried affirmations again. This time it was in service of a bet. My coworker at the bank had signed up for a class to help raise her GMAT test scores. That's the test you take to qualify for a master's degree program in business, better known as an MBA. I had taken the test in my senior year of college and scored a mediocre 77th percentile, meaning 23% of the people who took the test did better. It wasn't good enough to get into a top school, and so I had abandoned that dream. But for some reason that I don't even understand in hindsight, I bet my coworker that I could retake the test and beat her next score, whatever that might be. And I boldly, stupidly, proclaimed I would do it without a prep class. It was a dumb bet, given that she had scored in the 86th percentile on her first try and expected to do better because of the class. I took some practice tests at home and never scored much better than my original 77th percentile. I decided to put my affirmations to the test. I wanted to visualize a specific result, so I picked the 94th percentile because I thought that would be high enough to win the bet. I visualized opening the mail and seeing the 94 on my test result form. On test day, I felt I did no better than I had on my practice tests, but I kept up my affirmations on the 94th percentile and waited for the results in the mail. A few weeks later, the results arrived. I opened the letter and looked in the box with my overall score. It said 94. Perhaps I'm just a good test taker and my bet with a coworker inspired me. And perhaps hitting the exact score of 94 was nothing but a coincidence. All I knew for sure is that if affirmations had any kind of value, I should set my sights higher. But for the next few years, I focused on my day job and didn't use affirmations because things seemed to be going generally well without any help. I graduated from the Haas School of Business at the University of California at Berkeley, and assumed I was on my way to becoming a CEO of something important someday. And I didn't think I needed any help to get there. That plan did not work out. The next time I used affirmations, it was in pursuit of the rarest, most desirable job I have ever imagined. The affirmation went like this. I, Scott Adams, will be a famous cartoonist. That worked out better. Chapter 25. Timing is luck, too. When you practice affirmations and you happen to succeed in the area of your focus, it feels like extraordinary luck. That's how you perceive it, anyway. The Dilbert success story is engorged with lucky-sounding events. I'll describe some of the luckiest parts of my story so you can get a sense for how deep luck sometimes needs to run before you find success. The biggest component of luck is timing. When the universe and I have been on a compatible schedule, entirely by chance, things have worked out swimmingly. When my timing has been off, no amount of hard work or talent has mattered. Dilbert was the best example of lucky timing you will ever see. It wasn't a complete accident that luck found me. I put myself in a position where luck was more likely to happen. I was like a hunter who picks his forest location intelligently and waits in his blind for a buck to stroll by. The hunter still has to be lucky, but he manages his situation to increase his odds. I did something similar. I tried a lot of different ventures, stayed optimistic, put in the energy, prepared myself by learning as much as I could, and stayed in the game long enough for luck to find me. I hoped a buck would eventually walk by, and with Dilbert, it did. Let me give you a snapshot of the luck, timing, that needed to happen for Dilbert to succeed. For starters, I had to be born in a time in which newspapers existed and comics mattered. And I had to have the right genetic makeup for the work and the right upbringing. And it helped a great deal that I was born in the United States. My first comics editor, Sarah Gillespie, immediately saw the potential in Dilbert when she looked over the samples I submitted to United Media. Sarah was married to an engineer who worked at IBM. When he dressed for work, he wore a short-sleeved white button-up shirt with pens in his pocket, just like Dilbert. When the other syndication companies saw Dilbert and didn't relate to him, they sent me polite rejection letters. When Sarah saw Dilbert, she related to both the content and the writing, and she championed the strip against some heavy objections within her company. Had someone else been in Sarah's job, I believe Dilbert would have been rejected. There were only a handful of people in the industry who were gatekeepers for new comics. What were the odds that one of them would be married to a real-life Dilbert? For the first few years after Dilbert's launch, we had trouble getting any large metropolitan newspaper to pick it up. You need the first big paper to get on board before the others see it as a worthy risk. One day, an employee at the Boston Globe, whose job included looking at syndication submissions and recommending new comics to senior management, went on a vacation with her husband. She was driving. He was bored. The Dilbert sales packet happened to be in the car. The husband, who was, as luck would have it, an engineer, picked it up and started laughing. His wife didn't relate to Dilbert the same way, but she trusted her husband's reaction and recommended it for inclusion in the Boston Globe. With that sale in the bag, many of the newspapers in the Northeast followed suit. But sales in the Western United States were comatose. I later learned that the salesperson for that region wasn't a fan of Dilbert. So when he went on sales calls, he kept the Dilbert sales packet in his briefcase and showed other comics. Then the universe got involved. The salesman had a heart attack and died in a hotel room on the road. His replacement, John Matthews, identified Dilbert as the most sellable comic in United Media's stable. And sell it he did, to every newspaper he visited. John is the best salesman I've ever seen. Had he not been available for the job, or had the original salesman lived, Dilbert might have been a small comic that ran in the Northeast for a few years before fading into obscurity. The good timing for Dilbert was relentless. In the mid-1990s, the media was focusing on the disturbing trend of corporate downsizing, and Dilbert got pushed to the front of the conversation as the symbol of hapless office workers everywhere. Dilbert was on the covers of Time, People, Newsweek, Fortune, Inc., and more. I modified Dilbert to be more workplace-focused than it had originally been, and it became a perfect match of a comic with an era. At about the same time, technology itself became a celebrity. The internet exploded, the dot-com era happened, and all things technical were suddenly fascinating, even to the general public. In the 80s, Dilbert would have been nothing but another nerd